granddaughters, bunch of cars.
Folks, welcome back to the Action RC podcast. You know the drill. We're talking about RC racing both now and over the course of its history. Last week, if you were with us, we got to hang out with two-time world champ Jared Tebow to talk about his retirement, to talk about his journey through gas truck and into eight-scale racing, to talk about some of the kind of emotional challenges, some of the physical challenges, the preparation of racing at that level. It was an extraordinary conversation with Jared, and I'm delighted to continue this week to pick up some of the other parts of his story. Jared, welcome back, and thanks for returning.
Yeah, no problem, no problem. Looking to talk a little bit more of these podcasts. The time just seems like it goes by a little too fast, it seems.
And I'll tell you, if you saw my notes, there's a thousand questions I wanted to ask along the way but didn't get to. Last time we talked a lot about 8-scale. What I want to start with this time is thinking a little bit about 10-scale, because that is where a couple of your world championship wins came. But just kind of give us a sense of, you know, where along the line did you start doing some 10-scale racing? How did that move into 10-scale happen? You know, how quickly did you come to grips with it? Just give me a little bit of that background.
Yeah. So, you know, I started with the 110-scale gas truck and then, you know, started racing 8-scale and, you know, I drove for a Team Associated, and yep. So they had their electric program. So I raced a little bit of electric once I kind of turned into like a professional driver.
Okay. Yep.
I did the Worlds in 2003. That was my first electric Worlds, and it didn't go like that good, but I
That's
did a national.
Florida, right? The Worlds, yeah. In 2003. Yeah.
Yeah, I did the Nationals that year, and I did really good at the Nationals. I almost won two-wheel drive, buggy, and truck. Okay. And there was actually quite a bit of controversy at that race between myself and one of the Team Associated employees there, just kind of with like some team order type things that had happened.
Okay.
And so my dad and I actually went to Team Associated to have a meeting, and we told him I wasn't going to race 10 scale anymore if they're going to like try to control the race, basically.
Okay.
So 2004, I didn't race any 10 scale. Then 2005, Checkpoint, which was owned by Steve O'Donnell, who was, you know, one of my main sponsors, Checkpoint Motors, came about. So, They really wanted me to race 10 scale. So we went to Associated and said, hey, I'll race 10 scale again, but I'm going to use Checkpoint motors and batteries.
Yep.
So then they agreed to it. And actually my first 10 scale race back was the Cactus Classic, which was a really big race.
Yep.
In 110 scale, 2005.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I won two wheel drive.
Okay.
And I didn't even know that I won. I won the last main, and I had like a third or something in one of the other mains. And yeah, I won. I won Mod 2 Wheel at 05 Cactus, my first 10 scale race back in, you know, over a year, yeah. Like 2 years, or yeah, like a year and a half or something.
Yeah, yeah, a while. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. So then, yeah, I started racing again 10 scale. I went to the Worlds in 05. I got,
so that's in, are we in Italy in 2005?
Yeah, that was Italy. Yep. I think I got fourth in two-wheel drive.
So that's Neil Craig wins 2005, doesn't he, in two-wheel drive? And then I think it's Cav winning in four-wheel. Yeah.
In four-wheel. Yeah. Yep. Yep. I missed the four-wheel main. But yeah, I got fourth in two-wheel, which was awesome.
Hmm.
And yeah, 2005, I won a Roar. A Roar championship and mod truck. And then, 2007, in Japan, I had a really good Worlds and got second in two wheel drive. Thought I was pretty darn close to winning. I needed to just start a little bit farther up. And that last main, I think Mike Truey, he was doing this like weird jump rhythm. He was able to do this one jump that no one else could do.
Okay.
And he really jammed me up in the last main, and I needed to win that one. Like, I would pass him, and then he would do this silly jump, and he would pass me back. And like I would pass him in the infield, and he would pass me back on this stupid jump. And yeah, so I wasn't able to get to where I needed to be to win that. And then in four-wheel drive, I think still to this day, that's probably the best event I've ever driven. I did a lot of testing with that car. I did a lot of preparation, like we kind of talked about in the last podcast. I always took my world's preparation really, really serious.
Yeah.
And so there was a really cool track in Missouri that was kind of close to me that they let me kind of go there and like prep it how I wanted. And so I went there and did just a ton of running before the worlds and got really comfortable with my car. And yeah, like that race was just incredible. It's pretty vivid memory. Like I ran all of practice, all of qualifying, and like all of the mains without crashing one time.
Wow.
Even at
a pro level, that's impressive. Yeah.
Yeah. I know for sure. Like once qualifying started, like a marshal never touched my car. And, yeah, I qualified. I TQ'd every round except one, and I was leading, and my motor moved, and so I didn't finish.
Yeah.
And then I won the first two mains.
Yeah.
And so that was a really special event, just to win my first world championship. And I definitely wasn't going there as the favorite or anything like that. And yeah, it went so good, and I'm still just really proud of that drive. Like it was just, they were some really good mains, good battling with me. And
you talked last week about, you know, the challenges of coming down off a difficult worlds, and you know, I think we were particularly talking about 2010, you know, and almost not sleeping for days. Tell me about the flip side of that. Tell me, you know, about the aftermath of winning a world championship, that cascade of emotions that must have been there for you, that, you know, in the days and the weeks afterwards, to kind of go, you know, after all of this effort, like I actually am the number one driver in the world. I've won that IFMA world championship. But what was that kind of experience or emotion, or that emotional journey like for you?
Yeah, I mean, it was really good. I was really happy. You know, it's kind of unfortunate in motorsport. I feel like the lows definitely last a little longer than the highs.
Yeah.
You know, I do remember like being really happy, but sometimes too, almost not even happy, you just feel like relieved.
Yeah.
But I would say there, like I was super happy. It felt really good to win. I remember right after winning A2, like Jürgen from LRP gave me his phone so I could call my wife, and you know, we didn't have like live scoring or anything like that. So yeah. I don't even think she knew that I had won the first main or anything. And so, yeah, I just remember calling her and like, you know, telling her that I won, how happy she seemed and stuff like that. And yeah, it felt really good. I mean, you know, like I said, I've never really been one to like, you know, really like dwell on achievements or anything like that. But, you know, when you can say you're a world champion, like that's a pretty special feeling. So yeah, that was definitely a memorable race. It was just a beautiful track, a beautiful area, and yeah, it was awesome.
It's a nice thing to have next to your name, isn't it? World number one. So from there we go to, I think, 2011. It's a double podium for you in Finland. I think it's Finland in 2011 from a world championship perspective. What was that event like?
Yeah. Oh, that event was awesome. They did such a good job. That track was one of the best I've driven at, and the whole organization there was great. That was one of the best worlds, and that was tough. I was so close to winning both of those classes there. I was a lot closer to winning than what the result shows.
Yeah.
In two-wheel drive, I won one of the mains. I won the first main, like, super easy. So I really thought I was going to win two-wheel drive, and I think I was starting fifth or something and just could not get another main to really go the way I needed to go. So that was unfortunate. And then four-wheel drive, I had a really good opportunity to win. I was leading the first two mains at one point, and Yeah, just didn't. I crashed in one and then came right back. Like I finished, maybe 0.2 of a second behind Cavallari in the first main. And then the second main, same type of thing. I got into a lead at one point. And then I know there was some type of thing where me and Lee Martin got tangled up at the end of the straightaway. And unfortunately, I got like a stop and go. And then I came back and finished second still and like almost won. Like I was, 2 or 3 tenths behind Cavallari again. So like the first and second main, I barely lost, by one car length. And then I ended up finishing second in the last main. So I finished second, and got third
Third
overall.
overall. Yeah, that's
So
the
that
one.
was kind of a bummer.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was super close. I mean, a couple things just barely go a different way. I would have won both there. So that was a little bit tough, but I love that event. It was really cool.
It was definitely good to watch. It looked like an amazing venue and an amazing event and facility. Yeah, the racetrack was good. So 2013, we're back in the US. I think if my notes are right, we're racing the World Championships at Silver Dollar Raceway. I think by this stage you're driving for Kyosho, and you win the two-wheel drive World Championship. That's, in off-road, I mean, there's not really a hierarchy, but two-wheel drive is kind of special, isn't it? Especially for an American driver, where two-wheel drive has traditionally been king. What's it like to win that two-wheel drive championship? Driving for Kyosho, one of the few times to that point the race hadn't been won by Losi or Associated. Talk to me about 2013.
Yeah, that race was super special. For one, my wife and daughter went there. They don't get to go to many races. So to have them there to see that was just really, really special. And then for Kyosho too, I had a great re relationship with Kyosho. Chikuba, the 110 skill engineer, he was such a good guy. We were pretty close, and he actually took over being engineer at Kyosho, I think in 88. So 87 was when Joel Johnson won. And so it was from 87 up till, when I won 2013, when they won their next one. And so Chikuba was an engineer from 88 all the way up until 2013, and he had never, designed a car that won a world championship. So that was really special for him. And I was really happy to be able to like give that to him. And yeah, that race was crazy. Like on sugar with the mid motor, I kind of got the mid motor thing kind of going when I won the Cactus Classic that year. And I did it kind of sneakily. I had two cars. I did like all my practice with my rear motor car, but I had done a bunch of testing at home with this mid motor. So for like the last seeding round or something, I threw this mid motor car down, and then it was like way better.
That's
So
beautiful.
I didn't want to like let people test theirs, because some people had them, but people weren't driving them type thing. So then, yeah, I kind of like sneakily like won the Cactus Classic that year too, which was super special too. Kyosho hadn't won that race in two wheel, I don't think ever. And then the world's warm up, or no, it was the nationals. The nationals were held at Chico also that year, and my nationals went terrible. I finished 10th in two wheel, and just had a really bad race. So I wasn't feeling like super comfortable going there. And then, like I said, my world's prep always takes super serious. So there's that same track. It was in Novelty, Missouri. They always let me like do the track however I needed to get me ready for the worlds. And so I went and bought like, I don't know, 500 or 600 pounds of sugar, and they let me sugar their track. So I sugared this track. I practiced a whole bunch, tested a whole bunch of different front tires, and I felt the most comfortable with the AKA 3-rib front tire. And that's like what I really felt comfortable with. And so I kind of did the same thing as I did the Cactus, everyone was running this pro line front. So I ran the pro line front the whole time in practice until the last round. And the last round, I threw on this AKA front tire, and it was like all my comfort was there, my speed, but I didn't want to put it on before so that I didn't want anyone else to be able to try it. And so that race, you know, it was super crazy because this crazy rainstorm came. So qualifying actually got shortened, but I ended up TQ. And then for tour drive, no other mains got ran except for the A main. And the whole track, the track was like completely underwater overnight. They drained the whole track. They like resugared it. They rented all these huge like flamethrower torch things.
Yeah.
And they melted the track, and it like, they kind of like made asphalt almost.
It's like the top of a creme brulee almost. Yeah.
Yeah. It was like a creme brulee. Exactly like that. And so they're like, okay, well, we're going to give you a practice. And the traction was like all time high. And the first practice, it was a disaster. I was crashing nonstop. And I was super nervous, you know. I'm like, holy crap, you know, I need to win this, and it is not going good. So then we're going to have another practice. And we're going up, and as soon as we got on driver's stand, they're like, well, change of plan. This is going to be A1 because there's another rainstorm coming, and we don't have time.
Yeah.
So it's like you're going up there mentally thinking it's a practice.
Yeah.
And then they change it and say it's going to be A1. And, you know, I don't think my car was necessarily like set up the best there. And I squeaked out those first two main wins, but it was super challenging. I mean, I don't think anyone's car was really driving that good. Like that was so early on with mid motor, and like the traction level was so high. But yeah, the first two mains were crazy. I think Neil Craig started 10th or something, and me and him battled. And I mean, I only won the first main by like 0.2 or something. Like it was super close.
Yeah.
And then the second main was the same way, but with Mayfield. And he actually kind of like dive bombed me in the second to last or last turn. And, you know, like I think we hit or something, and but yeah, I barely won that one too. So that was a really good feeling. Like Joe Pillars was my mechanic, and he was so happy. And I was like, I ran down the driver's stand so fast after that race finished to like hug him and my wife and everyone. That was a really, really special, special race.
It's I can hear it in your voice as you tell the story. It's still special memories.
Yeah, for sure. Especially just having Megan be there.
Yeah. 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 So I was going to ask you about, I'll ask you about family a little bit later. We'll talk a little bit about Megan. Before we leave 10th scale, I just want to ask you about the next worlds, because the next worlds almost could not be more different. We're back in Japan. We're at Yatabe Arena. Unexpectedly, I guess, for lots of us around the world, the event runs on carpet. And I don't want to dive too deeply into the rights and wrongs of that decision. But I do want to ask how you, an outdoor off-road specialist who grew up racing gas truck and 8th scale buggy, come to TQ and almost win that tour drive event there on carpet, actually finishing behind Spencer Rivkin, another off-road guy. You know, how did you guys kind of come to be so far, so competitive on carpet at Yatabe Arena, you know, and beat all of the carpet specialists? Tell me about that Worlds.
Yeah, that Worlds was crazy. It was on turf. It wasn't on carpet.
Oh, turf.
Turf's a little bit different.
A little bit different. Yeah. My bad.
And yeah, no problem. I had never driven on either. And so I went there to the warm-up race, and it was a disaster. It was funny because me and Rivkin, we were in the B, and we actually battled in the B. I don't even remember who won. But me and him battled in the B at the warm-up, and I was just like, dude, I'm not going there to the Worlds to finish in the B main. So I was pretty dead set to have something better. And so, you know, some people had worked on this like four-wheel drive rear end, two-wheel drive front end, like conversion kind of car. And so I had got one of those kind of conversions and messed with it some. And then Kyosho actually made some parts to like really make it. And there was one carpet track in Missouri. It was like 2 hours away from me, small track. But like I said, my world's prep always really like go crazy on it. And so and there's always been someone that's like really stepped up. I mean, every world, there's always someone that really steps up to help me. And so I had a friend that went there a lot, and they kind of talked to the owner, and it was like kind of club brand, but they actually gave me a key to that place. And so I would go down there and just drive so much. Like I got so many sets of those Schumacher tires to just go down and practice. And I would say for a month, I was going down there twice a week, and I was driving like 30 to 40 batteries a day. And they were all just 5 minute like mock races. You know, every time I was on the track, it was a mock race. So we had the timer on, started, finished. And I mean, yeah, I think it was close to 40 batteries a day I would do.
Wow.
So I don't know, what's that, 80 a week times four? So yeah, 320 batteries. So I drove probably 320 mock races the month leading up to that race. And the conditions weren't the same really, but like I kind of explained, I need something that I'm comfortable with. Like when I'm comfortable and I know kind of like what my car is going to do, then I'm able to race really efficiently. Like I'm not the person that can like change their car all the time, because when I don't know what it's going to do, I just can't drive comfortably. So yeah, I went there completely as an underdog, and my wife went with me this time, which that made it really special. And we had a great time. And yeah, it's super unfortunate that I didn't win. I think, looking back, I think I had such a speed advantage. I should have held back some. But I wanted to just like, sometimes you just want to dominate, And I think I should have held back a little bit in some of the practice runs, like almost like what I did at the previous Worlds, to where I saved my good tires to the very last run. Like I should have maybe done something a little bit like that. And yeah, it was a bummer. Like I won the first main super easy, and like, oh man, like I have it in the bag. And then the
Spoke too
second
soon.
one, yeah, I just it caught me. I like wheelied somewhere. I like caught a dot and like wheelied and like flew off the track in the second main. And then the third main, yeah, they had like this small tabletop jump. Well, it was like the biggest jump on the track, and you hit it under braking, and I think I just hit it a little too hard under the brakes, and when the chassis bottomed out, it just jumped at a weird angle. It jumped kind of like nose high or something, and crashed on the landing. But yeah, that was a bummer. I mean, I look back on my world's career, and definitely in 1/8 scale, there's a couple of them that I feel like I really left on the table. 2004, I think I had a good chance to win. 2010, I feel like that was really one that got away. Even 2012, I think I had a shot to win. I was leading the semi, flamed out. 2016, I think I had a shot to win that one too. So, there's quite a few that slipped away there. And then 10 scale,
There's a
I
couple as
definitely
well.
had some I had some slip away. The two in Finland, and then the one for sure in Japan. So, it's like I'm super happy and proud of two world championships, and it's like, man, you know, if a
could
couple
have been
things
a couple
went
more.
Differently, like, you know, yeah, you know, you, you know, you, there could be, you know, 6 to 8 there total, maybe. But that's how racing goes. It's
it
not
is.
Easy. And that's
yeah.
what makes it feel good when you do win.
It is, you know, I probably overly focus on world championship racing, but I think they are extraordinary races precisely because they don't come around all that often. Everyone in the world is there. Everyone's brought their A game. And so to win them or to, you know, to run up front takes an extraordinary kind of an achievement. Let me just switch away from world championship racing for a few minutes. And before we leave the 10 scale scene, I just want to ask you about the Reedy race. I think you took a win in the Reedy race. I think it was 2019. Where does that kind of sit for you amongst, you know, all of the kind of high points across your whole career to win the Reedy race? How does that fit and sit?
Yeah, that one actually ranks really high. You know, I had a couple other like really good Reedy races to where, you know, I thought I was going to win. One of them, me and Dustin Evans tied, and like one of the races, I had a huge lead. And I crashed with like a lap car on like the second to last lap, and it made me just barely miss the extra lap.
Yep.
And that's what cost me the tiebreaker. Like, we tied in like so many different things, but if I would have made that one extra lap that I was supposed to make, then I would have won and you know, I had podiumed a couple times, and then, you know, kind of just the way that my career was going and things, like the Kyosho 10 scales weren't that good. And then I wasn't sure if I was going to race more. And then even joining Techno, I'm like, man, I don't know like how their four wheel is going to be. And, you know, I would say going to that race, I would say like leading up to it, or maybe in 2018, I was like, you know, I'm probably never going to win a Reedy race in my career. And then I really gelled with that four wheel, like on a certain grip level, like at my home track, the thing was like super good. And I went to that race really confident, actually. And yeah, the race went awesome. You know, that race, I would say, is similar almost to like an 8-scale worlds, where you have a lot of time to like think about it, because it's kind of just all heads up racing, but you can see like who you're racing, and you can see where you start, and you kind of, you pick like races like, oh, I can win this one, and oh, this one I only need to get second, and this one, and you're looking at other people's races, and you know, you're like, oh, they have easier races, or like, I have harder ones. And mentally, that race is really tough to only focus on yourself. Like, you can get so distracted by other people's races and starting positions and points that like you can't even focus on your own race. So that one ranks pretty high.
Yeah, I bet it does. Yeah. Jared, the other thing I want to talk with you a little bit about, and you're the first person I've had the chance to talk with about, is the Neo race in the UK. It's an event in a sense that became for a period something of an unofficial indoor worlds, maybe one of the most sought after race wins outside of those IFMA events, and a race that you became synonymous with. I think you won it 6 times or something over your career. Just, I mean, I'd love to hear you reflect a little bit about that, going to the UK to do that Neo race. What made it a special event, what it was like for you to go there, and how did you win so often? Just, you know, give me a bit of a story, the Neo story from your perspective.
Yeah, I mean, I love that race. I went to the first Neo, which was actually held in Belgium in 2005.
Yep.
And, you know, that was completely different track. It was like beach sand.
Yep.
The track layout was a complete nightmare. And but it was awesome. I loved it. There was only a couple Americans there, and the track was so gnarly and so rough, and I had a great time there and got the win. And then, yeah, when it moved to the UK, I didn't go until 2009. And I really like well-organized and well-run events.
Yeah.
And that race was just ran awesome. Like, you knew which time you're going to race. people followed the rules because the organizers were strict. Like, there was just no like BS there. You know, people turn marshaled, like, you know, no cutting the track and warm up, just like, no, there was just nothing just BS about that race, you know, and I loved it. Like the track size I liked. I don't really like really big tracks. So like that track was kind of long, but it wasn't that deep.
Yeah.
And it was always a really technical track layout. And so I'm a good technical driver. Like if you have to drive really accurate, I feel like that's where I shine. And the way that that dirt was and kind of how they formed the jumps and stuff, the jumps you always had to hit in certain areas and they always had like weird angles and just really technical tracks. And I just excelled on those tracks. And, you know, I think as they started kind of building, I just went there just, I mean, I went there fully expecting to win. And not to where I had pressure, like I had to win. Like it was almost a relief sometimes going there, like, okay, I'm going to go there and win. And then like my confidence is going to be back. Like I never even like questioned not winning there. And, you know, and it wasn't, and it never felt like I was under pressure. I loved going there. I liked the dorms. I liked just being able to like have my own room and walk to the track. I love the food there. That spice and rice. I mean, I still like know what it was called. I remember exactly what I would always eat. And I just loved everything about that race. I liked a lot of the English people too. Like I had a lot of friends there. I just enjoyed it.
Who were some of the people that, you know, that were significant in the running of that race in that were putting the event on or that you worked with when you went over to the UK for your own program? Give me a sense of some of the people that were there.
Yeah. I mean, Mick Craddock from, Kyosho Europe. I mean, he always, you know, helped me out, you know, would pick me up from the airport, take me couple times. Some other people did that were more so part of the like DXR crew, which was kind of like the club that put the race on. But yeah, like Mick and his family, I mean his wife and daughter and son were always there and we're always hanging out and stuff. I had lots of different pit guys at that race. It was like my normal pit guy Joe. I don't know if he ever went there. He might have went there maybe once. But yeah, I had different pit guys at different times. The track conditions kind of evolved. Like, you know, sometimes we ran on kind of like, you know, regular like outdoor style tires. And then towards the end, we started running more on like bar style tires, clay compound and stuff. And so that changed some. I think I liked it a little bit more when we ran the other tires to where the we didn't have as much grip. But
special race. Yeah.
I love that track. And you know, like even the conditions, like I don't like driving in cold weather really, but it was always cold. They always blew the fans like straight at the driver's stand. So your hands would be like completely numb in that race. But it never bothered me really.
Yeah.
And yeah, there was just something there. Like I gelled with that place, but yeah, it's crazy to think that, you know, I won it six times and it's just crazy. Like all the same people that raced there race at the Worlds, you know, it's like, you know, why couldn't I have won the World six times, but I won that race six times, you know? And so, you know, it's kind of tough to like label races and stuff. It's, you know, at one point, you know, I never thought I would really like my career would be okay if I didn't win eight skill worlds. But now after announcing my retirement and like looking back, you know, it doesn't matter at all to me that I didn't win that. I don't think I'm going to go to the worlds next year. So You know, I would say my career is gonna, you know, end without an 8-scale world championship, and I can honestly say it doesn't bother me at all. I'm pretty content with it, which feels good. A few years ago, I probably couldn't have said that, but
No.
you know, they're just races at the end of the day. And
Yeah.
you know, I've
Yeah.
definitely, you know, won some good races and battled with all the world's best guys and have a lot of good memories throughout the different races. But yeah,
Nice.
I love the Neo. I would love, you know, if the DXR, if they came back, that'd maybe be one race I would come out of retirement to go race.
There you go, DXR crew. If any of you are listening to this podcast, put the race on, and we'll see if we can get Jared out of semi-retirement to come over and do that. Jared, let's just talk about kind of quickly a few other bits and pieces along the way. You just talked there about some of the people you worked with in the UK. I'm curious about, and you've talked about Joe Pillars as one person that you work with quite closely. What's your, I guess, your reflections on the people that you've worked with, in your own team, in Team Tebow, if you like, in, in pit crew mechanics, those kinds of people over the years, particularly in 8-scale, I guess that team relationship and the trust that's in it has to be really important. So just talk to me a little bit about, some of the people and what they've meant to you to work with.
Yeah, I mean, I've worked with a lot of different people, you know, as far as like the different teams I've driven for, the different team managers. You know, I think I'm the last current racer that actually drove for Mike Reedy. So he was the team manager. You know, he gave me my first contract, my first paid contract when I was 14 years old. You know, I was paid $250 a month. My team associated, and Mike Reedy gave me that contract at a Reedy truck race actually, which was pretty special. You know, he is definitely an iconic person in the industry. You know, I worked really close with Steve O'Donnell. You know, it definitely ended sour and kind of, at a certain time. I mean, he was definitely an iconic person in the RC industry and had a huge influence. Was a big part of a lot of people's career. You know, he definitely helped me a lot. Richard Saxton was a really big influence on my career.
We talked
You
about
know, it
Richard
was
a little
kind
bit
of like
last week,
a
too.
yeah, kind of like a second father for me, I would say, at certain parts of my career. You know, my dad was obviously a huge part early on. You know, unfortunately, things kind of got cut short. He stopped traveling with me in like 2006. So then kind of like 2006, 7, 8, it was kind of just sporadic help here and there. A lot of my gas truck nationals, Eddie Fikes, who was a racer out of Vegas, he pitted me. Jason Ashton, who was a racer himself, he pitted me for a couple of my gas truck national championships. Then starting in 2009, when I went to Kyosho, I got kind of for the first time back like a full-time, you know, pit person mechanic, if you will, as Joe Pillars. And he pitted for me and glued all my tires pretty much my whole time at Kyosho. So 2009 through like 2017. The last year of Kyosho, we had someone else, Zach Rogers, who was the team manager. And so then he kind of took that role, pitted for me, glued my tires, helped me out. And we had a super fun year. He was a friend of mine, never really worked in the RC industry. And I was really burnt out, I would say, when that time, at that time. And so he kind of came in as like more of like a fan. And so he had a totally different like perspective, you know. And we really just had a ton of fun. We did some things like, you know, we would get some later flights and we would try to find something to do and things like that. And he definitely really helped me kind of find the joy back in RC. And then starting with techno, kind of just had some different people pit for me. Matt Walter, that works at Techno, and then even the owner, Danny. they both kind of pitted for me, but it worked out okay. Not really that good. You know, it's tough when like staff is pitting for you. I would say it just doesn't work out that well. Emotions and things get kind of heated sometimes in the moment of racing, and they're just a little bit too much involved in like the actual company. So then this guy, Graham Hill, we just kind of like, we knew each other. We weren't, I wouldn't say we were like friends really. And I was at SIC in 2021. And I needed a pit guy. I went there with no pit guy. And so he was kind of helping me. And then, yeah, it just kind of happened to where Techno was like, hey, you know, would he want to like travel with you? So I asked him. And so, yeah, he started traveling with me and going to all the races and stuff. And so that's kind of my latest one. And then my dad also, he kind of jumped in here and there.
Yeah.
2019 and 2020 and pitted for me some, which was awesome.
Yeah.
Me and my dad have had kind of a rocky up and down relationship, but we've tried to mend it. And having him at some of those races was really cool. So awesome. Graham Hill, I mean, he's been a great friend and a great help for me these past couple years, and he went over to Miyako to help me there too. And worked with a lot of really good people in the industry. My time with Kyosho, I had some different pit guys when I would go to Europe. Adrian Bertin pitted me sometimes, and he was a great mentor for me. I ran Orion engines and stuff. Mitt Craddock, I mean, he was, a great friend, and he pitted for me multiple different times. So, I've worked with a lot of people.
Yeah, yeah.
Yep.
The other thing I just wanted to ask you about, and we did touch on this briefly last week, your story almost cannot be told without kind of, noticing the parallel story of Cavalieri and Mayfield, the two Ryans. So just, I guess I'm, interested in, what it's meant to you to kind of be a part of that incredible trio of talent and go head to head with the two of them, and maybe say something about what you've admired about each of those guys on the racetrack as you've raced so often and so close and so hard over so many years, Cavalieri and Mayfield and yourself.
Yeah, it's I don't think there's really not that many industries or forms of racing to where that happens. Maybe a little bit in Supercross right now. There's some riders that have been racing for a long time, but I mean, like me and Cavalieri kind of pro ranks like really at the same time, like both being 13. Mayfield was a little later.
Yeah.
He was racing before me and Cavalieri both were, but took him a little bit longer to kind of reach that level.
Yeah,
maybe like I think 2003 Mayfield had his kind of breakout year. He won the Cactus Classic, and then kind of like 2004, 2005, he was, racing 8 scale and 10 scale at like all the big races. And, us three, like 2005 was like, us three were pretty much first, second, third at every race and every class. It was a really cool time. Like, we were all on Team Associated, and it was kind of like Cavalieri was on his own team and me and Mayfield were on our team. And like, we didn't really care who won, but we just didn't want Cavalieri to win. And so like, that's kind of how it was when we were all on the same team. It was like Cav kind of got the most attention, and so we were just wanting to beat him. But we were all still like pretty good friends. And like I said before, like we all just went through like stages of life together. I think all three of us are within 6 months of the same age. So I'm the youngest. I think Cav's the oldest. And then Mayfield's in between. And Yeah, I mean, man, it's really cool. I mean, we have there's so many crazy memories of just like hanging out at Cavalieri's house and in his hot tub and like us three like sharing like a bottle of wine and just talking life, and we have a lot of really good memories for sure. And we got to travel the world together and race together. I think, we all have had our little run-ins. Me and Mayfield definitely had a time to where, we tangled a lot for sure. But now, we definitely have a respect for each other. It's cool now, like we're all fathers and we can talk about our kids and stuff. We're not quite as close friends as we were at one point, but yeah, it's really cool to see. And I mean, yeah, we're all world champions, and it's pretty nuts really to think about it. And yeah, it's crazy, like we're all still racing. I guess I'm the first one to kind of end that. And it's weird actually. Neither one of them have actually said anything really to me about my retirement. Mayfield was at PNB and just kind of like gave me a hug or whatever, like after the video, but we didn't really say anything. But yeah, I haven't actually talked to those guys about it.
There's probably some unspoken things. It'll be interesting to see how that evolves over the future. The guys that I go mountain biking with now every other day are the guys that I went head to head with very hard for a long time in RC, and now we're, 20 years later, we're great mates. It'd be interesting to see how your friendship develops. Talk to me also about family, Jared. Over our conversation, you've spoken regularly about your wife, Megan. Megan, how much has she been a part of the story for you? What's family meant to you over, with respect to your RC kind of career and your journey? Are your own kids kind of going to turn into future world champions? Just reflect a little bit on the family side of your story.
Yeah, I mean, my family is pretty key. I mean, me and Megan, we met through RC. Her dad had a track, and she was selling Gatorades, and I was from California, and so we started talking, and we traded emails, and shoot, that was in 2003. And I asked her to, if she wanted to date me, and the first time she said no because I lived too far away. And then somehow I got her to change her mind, and we dated long distance for 3 years, and during that time was when I really went through some really tough times with both my parents. And so she was the one that was always there for me. So, she's been a huge part. I mean, a couple different times I kind of thought, I mean, if I would have, given up even just a little bit, like my career could have ended pretty easily a couple different times, with some different things that happened, mainly like, with my dad and him not being able to go to the races anymore, and then with the big thing that happened with Hobby Co at the end of 2008, that was a pretty rough time too. And yeah, she has always had my back, like no matter what. She's been super supportive. So, and it's not easy on her. I mean, like I said, it takes a selfish mentality to be at the top, and she had to deal with that. Like if I had to go to the track 7 days straight, she had to accept that whether she wanted to or not. And like if I had to go to a race on our anniversary, she had no say in it. If I had to go a race on her birthday, she couldn't say anything. And like I always kind of said, like, we always celebrate things, and it's like, okay, like that's just a day, like we're gonna celebrate it, and it's gonna be just on a different day. But some people don't accept that very well, you know?
Yeah.
And so, yeah, she went through a lot of tough times too. And, you know, she would see me on like my bad days and see me on my good days. And I think, you know, spouses and stuff with people that are in anything at like an elite level, like they take kind of that same like mental beating as the actual person going through it, you know.
Important part of the story, family. Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. And then, yeah, sorry, about the kids. Yeah, I mean, they do like RC. My youngest son, Nash, he really likes RC. You know, they got into it a little bit last year, raced some e-buggy, you know, to say like, oh, yeah, I want to have them racing and want to have them be world champion or something like that. I mean, I definitely don't like see that as something that I'm going to push at all. If they do want to race, you know, I think that's good.
Yeah.
You know, like I'm not against it. I still think that I like RC, you know, like I said, I kind of battle that back and forth a little bit, but you know, I can't have anything bad to say about RC. I mean, it's given me such a good life and I've been really, really blessed with what I have from it. You know, I put a lot into it for sure. It's not easy. I think making a living as a driver is only going to get more difficult. And it's pretty difficult as it is right now.
Yeah.
So as far as that side, I think it's, you know, I don't know if I would want to like steer them down that direction.
That's right.
But yeah, you know, I mean, they're 8 and 6 years old. So, you know,
pretty young. Yeah,
they just, yeah, whatever they want to do, whatever they think's fun is, you know, I'm definitely not pushing them. I mean, you know, my hobby is two wheels. Like I love bicycles.
Yeah.
They wanted to race BMX a little bit. We got into the BMX and then they're kind of over it. So we stopped and they're into mountain biking a little bit. You know, I would love it if they pursued mountain biking. They're both good. I mean, my 8-year-old, he's extremely good on a mountain bike, but, he's kind of hit or miss if he likes it a lot. You know, he doesn't like his legs hurting. So that's
that is a problem with mountain biking. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. And I'm just like, dude, like it's like you'll get used to it, you know, like your legs are always gonna hurt a little bit.
That's the way it is.
And so, you know, I don't know. It's whatever they want to do. Like I don't want to push them down anything and like force them, you know, to do anything, but I don't want to stop them from doing something that they want. So, you know, if they want to play sports and do that, then I'm cool with it.
Yeah. That is the way of being a dad or a mom, a parent, isn't it? Of helping your kids find their own path to follow. Yeah. Jared, two last questions. I want to have a bit of a where to from here as we wrap up. But before we get to that, you've been quite open over the course of your, career life around your own Christian faith, and I want to recognize and acknowledge that faith spirituality is a very personal thing and it means many different things to many different people, but I do just want to ask you just briefly about what that part of your life means to you, and you know how that does kind of fit into the way you see yourself and the way you see your RC career.
I've chosen to be open about that, mainly because I feel like you know, God really has me in this position for a reason. You know, and I think I would be doing it a pretty big injustice if I wasn't to be sharing, you know, sharing my faith and sharing my story. You know, my path and my story has been, you know, difficult at times, and a lot of times I'm really like, it's not that comfortable being open.
Yeah.
It's pretty scary a lot of times, and even it's like I don't even want to say some of the things that I say, but it's, sometimes it just comes out, and I feel like, God's just really given me this tool to use, or he's, I'm the tool or something, and he's using it. 'Cause sometimes it's like, I don't plan to say it, or I don't, it just kind of comes out. But yeah, I mean, my Christian faith is an interesting story too. I'd like to share about it a little bit.
We've got
I
a
was
couple of minutes.
raised
We
in,
are we're going to run out of time fairly quickly, but give me a bit of a sketch.
I mean, I was raised atheist, and was pretty certain that that's kind of the way that I was going through my teenage years, and then met my wife now, Megan, and her family. They went to church and they were Christians, and so when I would go over there to visit with her, they never judged me or anything. They didn't like ask me all these questions, like why I didn't go to church or like why I didn't believe in God or anything. And, I was respectful to them too. I went to church when they, if I went and visited and stuff. And then I started going through some of these really hard times, with my mom and dad, and Megan was always just super supportive and, never like pushing it on me, but, just, basically like, if you really need help, there's someone out there that, will love you, will help you, will guide you through life. So yeah, that's just kind of how it happened. I mean, it was, when my dad was in prison and I was just really struggling. I was 18, living on my own, and just needed some sort of guidance. And yeah, I got saved, and yeah, kind of from then on, I just like, man, I have to just share my story if I have the opportunity.
Yeah. Thank you, Jared. Thank you for sharing that part of your life and that part of your story. I appreciate that. It is time for us to wrap up. So let's kind of come back to where we started these conversations 3 something hours ago, over the last couple of weeks of the show. Where to from here? I mean, I've heard in, as you've spoken, some uncertainty really around, you feel like you kind of almost don't ever want to see another RC car, but just tell me a little bit about what the rest of this year holds. Are there some big races that you're going to do? Is there any temptation to get you to the 10 scale worlds? That's going to be such a big event. But what are these next few months look like, as you kind of wrap up this pro stage of your career?
Yeah, pretty uncertain really, like what next year is going to look like. This year I'm planning to, still do kind of all the big races that I've been doing, the nationals and like the Racetime races. I'll be at Silver State. I'd really like to possibly go to Europe this year and do a race or two. Not 100% sure if that's going to be able to happen or not, just with like some travel budget things. But I'm hoping that could happen. I have a lot of fans in Europe, a lot of friends that I would really like to see again and race there. I kind of announced like I wanted to announce it early to kind of have like a farewell tour type thing. So there's definitely some races I still want to go to. Man, I've tossed around the idea of the 10 scale worlds a couple times. I talked to the Schumacher guys quite a bit. I would say like the last 4 years, I've kind of talked to the people at Schumacher, and they seem super cool, and they've always been open to have me try their cars. And I think they'd be super willing to help me go to the worlds. But I think for now, I don't think there's any chance of me going to go there and do it right. I'm not willing to make that time sacrifice. Just my life at home is so different now. Like the kids are older, like we do homeschool.
Okay, there's a lot
We,
going
you
on.
know, like my kids are in sports now, and then my JTP business is growing a lot. I mean, it's grown so much in the last 2 years. Like I pretty much do orders all day long. We're shipping I don't know, 5 to 10 orders a day, every day of the week. And
good to hear. That's good to hear. Yeah.
Yeah. It's really good. So I don't know. I'd like to go to Ten Screw Worlds, but I have no desire to go there and be in the B main.
Yeah.
And for me to go there and compete how I would like to without racing 10 scale in 4 years would take a lot of effort and just.
As a long-term Schumacher fan, Jared, I'm going to beg you to reconsider. And No. I understand completely. It's a big, I guess, I imagine there's some temptation being that it's in the US. It's your last year of full-time kind of racing, but I can understand the difficulty of making that all count.
Yeah.
If you want to come down and race in Australia, the Asian Buggy Championships are on in my hometown in July. The race is sold out, but I'll withdraw. You can have my spot. And never mind. Jared, it is time I let you go.
I do want to go to New Zealand, though.
Oh, okay.
I want to go to New Zealand and race. Well, I want to go to New Zealand to ride mountain bikes.
Oh, yeah.
But I would maybe try to sneak in an RC race if possible. Yeah.
Come to Australia and we'll take you to Tasmania and ride mountain bikes down there. Some of the best riding in the world. Jared, it is time I let you go. Thank you so much for being so generous with your time. I've really appreciated the extended conversation we've had, the journey through your career, your own personal life, and you know some of the challenges along the way that you've been really open and honest with. And so I just want to say thank you. Thanks for joining me on this conversation and for being available.
Yeah, no problem, man. Really appreciate it. And thanks for what you're doing with the podcast. And thanks for inviting me. Happy to share my story.
Beautiful. Folks, that's the end of a two-parter with Jared, an extraordinary collection of stories from retirement. If you go back and listen to the first part of last week's show, you know, where the career went from a secondhand gas truck in a hobby shop to world championship racing in a little over 12 months. But some of the extraordinary stories, the connections, the people. I'm reminded as we've had this conversation of that saying that it takes a village to raise a child. But I think it also takes a village to make a world champion. And, you know, as we've heard Jared speak about track owners who've been generous to open their tracks to help him prepare for worlds, manufacturers he'd work with, pit crew, family, success comes from the whole community. And this story in particular has been a real testament to that. Thanks for being with us. We'll be back on the show next week with some more fun conversations.